Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of December 30th. I'm John Gibson, and with me early on a Saturday morning is Jim Allen. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing well. We're maybe early in Japan, but we're prime time in America, baby.
This is prime workout time for me usually, but coming back from one actually. But
this is actually kind of just normally. I shouldn't have stayed up this late, but I'm finally getting to bedtime.
right. Whoa, the sun's chasing me in the bed. Yes.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yep. Well, guess what this is? This is our first last show of the year.
Hold on. Okay.
In the Reiwa era.
Oh, man.
Now, I knew you would love that.
That was really like super stealth. I was going, where is John going with this? Okay, this is our last show.
No. It's our first last show of the year in the Reiwa era.
That is correct.
That's right. Something
it's
I knew
also
you would
our
love.
Our last show of the first year of Reiwa, which is less dramatic, but equally accurate.
Equally accurate.
and how normal people would see it. So for all you normal people out there, that's what it is. The rest of you, congratulations for getting John's logic.
Okay. All right. Well, on this week's show, we are going to talk to former King Tetsu Buffalo, Oryx Buffalo, and Yomiuri Giant pitcher Jeremy Powell. We're going to look at free agency. We're going to talk about the Hall of Fame and handle some high heat. The bases are loaded, so let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases!
Okay, now for the last year, I've been chasing Jeremy Powell, which is not fair because he's got a 3,000-mile head start on me, being based in the United States.
Right. And he's not running, technically.
He's not running. Okay, yeah, okay. So, I'll say that. Actually, I missed. It's more like 5,000 miles, but you know, what's 2,000 miles between friends? So anyway, we got talking about this and that just a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we should do an interview. Okay, let's do an interview. Okay, so we were talking about when's a good time because JP's really busy. He's got a minor league pitching coach gig with the Miami Marlins that he's had for forever now. And so his schedule is really it's a little shifted, a little different from the major league schedule. So he doesn't have the same time off,
right,
as other people, because you know he's got to do this, he's got to do that. So it was really hard to coordinate. And I thought, well, whatever I thought. Well, the day after Christmas was really a good day for us, and I finally caught up with him, and the stars were aligned, and we could chat. Via phone from his home outside Phoenix, Arizona, and it was just a blast. And Jeremy's a great guy, and it's a good thing that his wife was there because you know with and his family was there with things to do, because otherwise we probably would have talked until I was 2 or 3 hours late for work. and you know, and his family, you know, with like holding knives to his throats or something, but the two of us are pretty much just chatterboxes, so we would have just gone on and on and on and talked about, you know, how smart we both are, and it would have been fun. But it was such a blast, you know. It was just so much fun. So anyway, we caught up the day after Christmas and got the interview finally done, and here it is. Okay, our guest this week on the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast is a longtime friend of the podcast, Jeremy Powell, former everything. Former Kintetsu Buffalo, Oryx Buffalo, Yomiuri Giants, SoftBank Hawks, Montreal Expo, Los Angeles Dodgers, you name it, he's been there. So thanks for joining us, man.
You're welcome. Good to hear from you again, Jim.
Well, we did get to see you, so that was really a treat. We're talking to Jeremy from his home in Arizona. Now, where are you in Arizona?
I'm in North Phoenix.
Okay.
In a little community called Anthem.
Okay.
In North Phoenix. It's about 30 minutes north of downtown or so.
Okay. We love Phoenix. My wife and I have been there the last 2 years for spring training. You know, with all the Japanese players in the area, it seemed like a natural. So Well, I don't know. What time, when do you leave for, well, you're in AAA, and when do you leave for your minor league spring training?
Well, I'll be going there for major league spring training, which starts, as you know, like middle of February.
So Florida.
I'll probably be leaving Phoenix, you know, that second week or so of February. And
okay.
I'll be down there all the way through.
Okay. So yeah, well, now we've got three guys in the Grapefruit League, and I'm almost leaning towards Florida this year, but I haven't pulled the trigger on that one.
So, no, I totally understand. Phoenix is a great time. That's a great weather time of year, you know.
It's beautiful. Well, you know, it depends. Some years we get the cold weather, some years we get the hot weather, but we always get one hike up Camelback Mountain, and it's a blast. And anyway, first of all, we talked just about a year ago, and we set up this, and we started talking about an interview about a year ago, because of the Hall of Fame, because we were talking about our buddy Tuffy Rhodes, and the Hall of Fame, the vote is in, and we won't know the results for a couple of weeks. But you told me a story, and it was kind of a surprise to me, because you said that Tuffy was in some ways responsible for your career in Japan. And could you tell us that story?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I obviously I was a new foreigner to contention Buffaloes back in 01 when I got there in June, and you know, it's kind of a rough adjustment for us coming over there right away. It's a big adjustment for us to not only get acclimated to the surroundings in a new country and a whole different culture of people, but you know, it's a tough adjustment leaving baseball in America behind and adjusting to what's in front of you there.
Right.
You know, in order to have success there, that I later found out, was you've got to be willing to embrace all of that. And, you know, some of us kind of get over that hump and have, you know, a chunk of time over there, and some of us kind of never do. And I think what attributes to either case is your surroundings and the people that you're around, whether it be your wife, your girlfriend that's there with you. She's either having a good time and loving it and allowing you to be effective, or she's miserable, which in turn makes you miserable. So, you know, in my case, I had a great girl I was going to marry that loved it over there. And I had teammates that were awesome. And Tuffy was the biggest part of that. I had two interpreters that were great as well. You know, I had a mixture of really good things on my side. The manager and the coaching staff was great. You know, but Tuffy was the American, and Tuffy was the guy that had been there, and, you know, Tuffy was the guy that was already successful and kind of got over that hump, and so he, you know, he knew he had a good team in the Buffaloes that year, and they had a chance to win. When I got there in June, you know, I spent 2 weeks in the minor leagues, and then when I went and joined the major league team there, they were winning, and they hadn't won in a while.
So, right.
You know, Tuffy knew that. You know, there was effort there to get some people over there to help them continue that win, winning. So, you know, he really took us under his wing and just helped us kind of mentally get through some of those roadblocks and, you know, kind of get through the red tape and just kind of have a right mindset, you know, to have success not only that year, but to stay there and have success and have that kind of a mindset. And until you have that as a foreign player, you know, it can be a rough road for you. So,
right.
You know, I owe, you know, the rest of my career after that year to Tuffy in a lot of respects because of what happened. I had an incident with the pitching coach, you know, one day that kind of came to a head where, you know, he was taking me out of a game, that, you know, earlier than I wanted to come out. And, of course, I let him know about it on the field, and he kind of let me know about that he didn't like it on the field. And we kind of had a run-in, and, you know, I was at my boiling point, and, you know, that the next day he and I had a conversation, and, you know, he really just kind of, without physically slapping me in my face, he slapped me in my face, you know, with the conversation we had, and that kind of woke me up and turned me around. So, you know, I have a lot of respect for him, his career, and what he did for me and other foreign players along the way.
So that was Tuffy who told you how things were in Japan?
Yes.
Yeah, that's...
Yes.
Because when we spoke about it, I thought, wow, you know, it's so important because just from my point of view, I mean, on a very strictly objective level, he's just one of the greatest players who ever played here, regardless of nationality or origin. But the other thing, to have an impact on your teammates is really huge, because he impacted not just his career and not just the people who played with him, but a lot of careers.
Yes. Yep. No, totally. I agree totally. You know, he kind of stepped outside of what he was doing and worried about what he needed to do and just helped us over there, you know, so
wow.
It was awesome.
Okay. Well,
I'm blessed and I'm thankful that I was in that situation. I mean, I had Tuffy again, like I said, I had Tuffy. I had a couple of good interpreters. Mm-hmm. I had a great manager that was communicative to us.
Yes.
And I mean, I was very fortunate and lucky to be in a situation, you know, to be able to kind of go through that hard time and get through that and still get the ball and go pitch and kind of learn how to stay there. So, you know, a lot of guys don't get that opportunity. They bring us over there to help them. And when you don't help, you're out, you know? So, you know, for me, I was in a great situation and I'm thankful that I, you know, I had guys like Tuffy to help me kind of get over the hump and get through that tough time.
You know? Now, the couple of incidents happened during your career there. One, 2004 was, you know, your first team, the Kintetsu Buffaloes. You won the Pacific League that year in your first half season. I'll never forget Tommy Lasorda was at the Japan Series. And he came up and he shouted at you and said, "JP, remember, it's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog."
That's right.
Everyone's just kind of, well, doing the usual, "Oh, Tommy's talking."
Yep. No, he had a lot of fire. He probably still does. I haven't talked to him in years, but
he still does.
Another one that I owe a lot to. He would come over a couple times a season, you know, during those times, and he would just sit in the kitchen at the Osaka Dome and just fire us up with the stories and, you know, and just so much passion and, you know, it was awesome. You know?
Yeah, he's great. And and a colleague of mine just was with him the other day and said he's looking better than he has in years, which is always good news. So now I want to move on. Now, in 2004, there, you know, the Buffaloes were at the focus of that, of the labor dispute and the strike that, and the team ended. Now, I know you weren't part, you had no choice in the matter about going to Oryx, but, you know, you had to see the effect on all your Japanese teammates, even with the language barrier. And I know Mr. Nashida had two things going on that year. He had not only did he have his team dying on him, he had cancer, which he got over. But it was a really hard year for a lot of your teammates. Now, what was your viewpoint from that?
You know, honestly, it was kind of weird. And it was really weird when we played Rakuten that first year. You know,
oh, in 2005, right? Because all your former teammates were playing for the Eagles.
Because I'm playing with you know, guys, half my team, and then half my team's over. I'm playing against now.
So right.
Guys that you know, I was able to kind of develop a relationship with are suddenly on the other team, and so that was weird. But, you know, at the end of the day, Jimmy, just go to work, and you just try to control what you control. But that definitely was a little weird how that next season. Coming back and all of a sudden half your team's gone and
right,
you know, half of a team that you played against the year before is now your teammates,
right?
And half of your team that you were with are now going to be against you. It's just it was really weird.
It was very strange, and I absolutely share that. Now, and you moved to the Giants in 2006.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
And now tell me about that, because well, Tuffy was with the Giants in 2004 and 2005, and then you went in 2006. Now, you did really well your first year. Now, tell me, what was that transition like? Because changing teams, you know, it's a little bit like going to a new country because the coaches are different. Sometimes they see something different. You have different relationships.
There's absolutely
different dynamics.
It was definitely different. You know, I was coming into a much larger contract, you know, personally than I ever had. And so that, you know, with that came a lot of pressure and knowing I was going to the Giants, that's a big team there and everybody knows that. And so that there's a lot of there's high expectations anyways.
Right.
Coming, you know, with the foreign player, but you know, making that decision to go to that team, you know, the expectations were even higher. And so, you know, you just kind of move forward and forget about the past and try to just prove your worth and prove that you deserve to be there and you deserve to pitch for the Kyoto. I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of what my mindset was, is, you know, I got to go prove why they wanted me. I got to go prove, I got to go prove that I deserve to be there. And you know, it's never easy to leave. Again, it's never easy to leave teammates that you develop relationships with, but, you know, people move on and get contracts at other places, and it's just kind of the nature of the business.
Sure.
Certainly the expectations were a lot higher playing, you know, for the Tokyo Giants.
Yeah, certainly. I know Tuffy's one of these guys. He alludes to these things, and he says, Jim, I'm gonna tell you all about it, but, you know, at some unspecified date before we're both dead.
He's
got them all. He's got all the stories, but he's making sure that I'm not partial to him. So I keep trying to hook up to him when I'm in Phoenix, but he's elusive.
Yep. No, I hear you.
You know, tell me about that, going to the Giants, and I've talked to dozens of players who've made the jump from other teams to Yomiuri, and it's always a little bit of a culture shock. You can do this, and you can't do that, and
it is, and, you know, I mean, it's just, again, nature of the business, and, you know, it's hearing about that they're the Yankees of Japan.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, all those expectations about, you know, how you're going to carry yourself, and, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, it's not that much different than how you already were before.
But right.
Again, you know, out in public and when you're traveling and, you know, everything is kind of heightened, you know, everything's kind of under a little bit more scrutiny, and so
right.
You've got to just kind of know that going in, and you know, you just kind of learn to try to adapt to their culture as a team, and, you know, try to fit in. It's like you're just trying to fit in again, you know.
Yeah. So. Well, I hear you. Even I've been doing this now for 25 years or so, and I still had a new run-in with a team about the team rules. I mean, like, I thought I'd learn never to say some of the stuff I said when I heard about some stuff, you know. And I had a team executive looking at me at the winter meetings like, haven't you learned anything? And he was completely shocked. I said, you know, what this stuff is like, it's like, I don't know what, it's like Nazi Germany, your team's rules. And he just pouted. He wouldn't talk to me.
Wow.
I'm going, man, it's like 19, it's like, going back 35 years to what the day I first walked into the country, I was shocked. So these things are always going on. They're, you know, you never get old enough to you know, there's no way you'll ever know everything.
Right. No, totally.
So, totally. Okay. Now, the one thing, when you changed to the Giants and you changed the name on your uniform, I don't remember this, but John did. Would you go to JP or something, or?
I'm trying to remember. I know I was JP. My jersey said JP on the back of the Oryx Buffalo jersey.
Okay.
It was Powell, I think, with Kintetsu, and I think it was back to Powell again. With
okay.
I think it got changed to JP maybe for that one year in 05.
Okay.
Before I went to the Giants, and then, of course, with the Giants, it just went back to my last name.
Okay. Was there any input from you? Because I know sometimes I remember asking Tsuyoshi Shimoyanagi why his walk-on music with the Fighters was Queen's Fat Bottom Girls, and he said, I have no clue. He says, one of the few times he would ever talk to the media, he said, I don't know, I didn't choose it. So was there any input? Did they say, I want to be JP this year?
No, you know, they actually asked me. They
okay.
Asked me if it was okay that they do. I was okay with it. I was fine okay. with that. I mean, you know, that's kind of what everybody called me, you know, anyways.
And okay.
So I rolled with it, you know.
Okay. Okay, well, John, that was a mystery for people with good memories like Mr. Gibson.
No, so, it wasn't one of those where I walked in and said, I want to be JP this year.
And, so, yeah.
They brought it to me, and I was good with it. And, you know,
okay.
It was JP's son anyways, and so
okay.
They just kind of rolled with it.
All right. Okay, well, I want to thank you for joining us on the podcast. And before we go, I just want to catch up with for our listeners. And so currently you are the – I don't know how many pitching coaches they have in AAA with the Marlins, but you are the or a AAA pitching.
I am the pitching coach. Each level has one pitching coach. So I'm getting ready to go for my third year, my ninth year coaching with the Marlins.
Wow.
And my third in AAA with them. So.
And where's their AAA?
We've been in New Orleans in the Pacific Coast League, okay. But our owners moved us out of there. We're starting. This year we're going to be back in the same division in the Pacific Coast League, but we're in a brand new stadium in Wichita this year.
Wichita. Okay.
Wichita, Kansas. And so it's definitely a lot closer to home for me. But it's a brand new stadium. It's a $75 or $80 million stadium. And, they're really excited to have us. And, so it's going to be kind of a 180 for us. In New Orleans, we weren't drawing any fans for the last 5-8 years or so.
And okay.
So, this is going to be a big deal. They're really excited to have baseball back in Wichita. And so, we're lucky to be kind of the first affiliated team to go back there. So it looks like the stadium's coming along really well. So it should be fun. Looking forward to it.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And we look forward to catching up with you in the future.
You're welcome, Jim. Good talking to you.
Okay. Thanks again, Jeremy. Good to hear from you.
Good hearing you, buddy. I hope to see you and those three fine sons of yours soon. He posts some pictures sometimes on Facebook of his sons. One of them plays football, so
yes,
they're going to be good athletes too. Big, long, tall guys. So yeah,
very handsome family. I know. I was telling him that when I remember his oldest son when he was shorter than their cream Labrador. and now he's bigger than his dad.
yeah, they're big.
So, Mr. Gibson, was there anything in there that struck your fancy?
I loved the entire chat, but I guess the biggest impact that the comments that he gave us and shared with us, I think, were how he just humanized the baseball experience in total. These are people before they're anything else, like players or coaches or managers, and they take a lot of abuse from fans who don't agree with maybe strategy or outcomes or approach or a lot of things, but we just see them at the baseball park and it's very easy to get angry or even be happy and be thrilled with what they do, but they're human. And so, you hear him talk about how Tuffy helped him out and was part of his baseball life here, was a big part of his baseball life. And I'm sure there are a lot of other stories about players whom Tuffy helped out and how he has had an impact, not just in terms of putting up numbers, but he had the impact like this on another player. And it's not unusual. We heard Mayo talking about it. I think it's not something we didn't see in the movie Mr. Baseball, where the guy who had played in Japan for a while was helping out the newcomer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a unique experience, but it's so necessary. It's so part of the game, just like the umpires. It's not something you can't have a game without it. And you need these guys to come in and not just tell you how it goes, but show you how it goes and show you the ways. And that's such an important part of the success or failure that guys have here. I mean, it's not like I always hear, we hear and we talk about it and we keep harping on it. We have since we started the show that the preparation and the different thinking is ingrained in baseball here, and that it's so hard to have success if you don't change the way you think and approach the game. But when you hear Jeremy talk about, well, if your girl is miserable, then it extends to you and you end up being miserable if you're living here and things are not fun. And I don't think that, you're standing in the batter's box or you're on the mound and you're thinking, oh, after the game, I'm going to go home and my wife or girlfriend is going to say this or that. I don't think that's what happens. I think what happens is because you're having to deal with other things, I won't call them distractions, but because you have to put your attention.
I call them life.
Yeah, life. You have to deal with this other parts of life or these other parts of life. that you don't get in as much preparation time as you should, or even mm-hmm. though you're looking at the data or you're studying, it's not being absorbed fully because you're thinking about other things as well. And so that impact on the preparation is probably what might impact yep. results. So I mean, it's just fascinating to hear a guy talk about that kind of detail about how a player goes about trying to have success here. It's not just having success on the field during a game. Because the game is what, 3 hours or 4 hours. There's a lot more time to do preparation, to get yourself ready physically, and you can do the physical work. But the mental preparation and that kind of study, that's very difficult. And I just loved how he talked about those things.
Yeah, I mean, you notice that. I mean, I've had, all I can say is yes, and more yeses, because everybody talks about it a little differently. And I think this is sort of the fun thing is when you ask a player the question, you know, what made it work for you or what didn't make it work for you, you know, in the case of our last guest, Matt Skrmetta, the answers are completely, you know, it's like looking at two different watercolors. Mm-hmm. Oh, you can see they're both watercolors, but this one's dark and this one's cheerful. Everything depends on the individual and his circumstances, their background, you know, where they came from, where the teams they're going to, who's surrounding them. And in Jeremy's case, he's really dedicated to the people who helped him. I mean, that's obviously a huge impact. Of course, as you said, he's got three kids and a great wife. And I remember meeting them at the airport in 2001. We were going to the All-Star game. I was mm-hmm. going to cover the All-Star game, and I was on the same plane with Jeremy and his wife, and I had met him. I take this back. It was, I think, 2002, because 2001 he had just arrived and he wasn't on the All-Star team, so it was 2002. But okay. They were at the airport, and we're sitting in the lounge, and he's introducing his wife to me, which is not really typical behavior, because I'm just the foreigner guy there. But they were both very friendly and outgoing from word go. And so it's very much in character for him to bring up the people side of it. He's very strongly in his career. He was very strongly affected by other people, not always positively. I mean, positive in his case, but he went through, of course, the incident. When you mentioned the teams he played for, you omitted the last one, which was the SoftBank Hawks, which came about after a whole pretty much a scandal with the Oryx Buffaloes, who wanted to re-sign him when he left the Giants, but had second thoughts after seeing an MRI after they had an agreement, and then wanted to rewrite the contract.
Mm-hmm.
And when they decided to do that, he said, well, we don't have a complete contract. I'm going to go to a team that's going to give me what you promised me originally. And then they then announced that they had a contract as if to scare away the other team. It was really weird, but he was really, he felt betrayed by the people with Oryx, and some by people who were just doing their jobs. They were doing their jobs, which was to say Oryx is right and you're wrong. But he was really, it's not like, oh, these people are doing their jobs, but the whole family thing, or not the family thing, but the personal thing really hit him very hard in that whole debate. And again, it was nothing. The Japanese press made it out like, oh, here's a foreigner. He signed double contracts, because foreigners do those kinds of heinous, insidious things. And Japanese players would never do that. And I've written about this a half dozen times, so I won't bore you about it. But this is something that used to happen all the time with Japanese players before the draft started, and it was clear who had the rights to sign players. When every team could sign every player, it was an annual rite to see which player had signed multiple contracts.
You get a contract, then you get a contract.
Tetsuya Yoneda is the best example. He was he's a Hall of Fame pitcher from the Hankyu Braves and briefly the Hanshin Tigers, who signed one contract with the Tigers and then he turned around and signed another one with the Hankyu Braves. And essentially the commissioner had to take him into his office and say, "Son, now which family do you want to live with after your adoption?" You know, kind of thing.
After your adoptions.
Adoptions, exactly. So anyway, so that those things happened all the time, but in today's day and age, everybody was blaming the foreigner, which I want to get to because, you know, you mentioned the network being so important. And there was two bits of news this past week, and we were talking about this after the podcast interview, about how the Hanshin Tigers made a big deal about their scouts going to spring training this year to help the new guys.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they made a big deal about it, but some reporter said, "Wow, what a big deal. Okay, this is normal behavior for most teams now. Bring your overseas scouts to your spring training camp to help the new guys get over the hump, you know, to iron out some of the, you know, navigate some of the difficulties in making the adjustments." And most of the teams do it. So I'm guessing Andy Sheets and Jeff Williams. I know Jeff Williams will be in the Tigers camp in Okinawa in February, and I suppose Andy Sheets will be there as well. To help out. But this is normal. Other teams have been doing this. And the Tigers, Tom O'Malley used to do that year after year after year. So it's not new, but it's so important. So for Jeremy to talk about it is not a surprise, but it is refreshing. I think the whole idea that this is it was also what I thought was really interesting, because my take on it was, not that they're human. I kind of understood that, but don't always. But I mean, I kind of understand that. But I think what struck home to me was that it's an individual game that requires more than one person to succeed.
Right. I equated with like my hobby of marathon running, because you need so much coordination and so much cooperation and so much assistance that you're running on your own two legs, but there's a lot of people out there who have helped you get to the finish line.
It's not exactly,
you know, you're not running alone. So I equate it to that.
You know, everyone who wins an award say, "Oh, this is my award and it's a team reward and, you know, it's just a script," but it's not just a script. I mean, you know, none of us do anything alone. So I can't go on vacation unless my colleagues are willing to take up the slack on the desk.
Exactly.
Okay, so anyway, so yeah, that was good. And of course, the other thing was about Tuffy Rhodes, which was, this is how I'll allude to this, because this is how the conversation got started. We were talking about Tuffy Rhodes' impact and the fact that I'd written a story last January about, you know, what is up with the Hall of Fame voters in Japan about Tuffy Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeremy saw it and he got to me on Facebook and said, "I can't believe these people." And he said something which was, he wouldn't replicate in our interview for the podcast or afterwards, but he was outraged. He said, "If Tuffy Rhodes hadn't been here, I would have been out of Japan in a heartbeat."
Right.
And it was one day he had a run-in with Shigeru Kobayashi, the Kintetsu Buffalo's pitching coach, and he said, "I'm done. I'm going home." And that was the story he told me a year ago. I'm going home. I'm finished. And had Tuffy not got in the way, you know, that 7-8 year career, his life, you know, the best part of his life in baseball would have been over. And that's a huge impact.
Right.
And as you said, that's a huge impact on other people's careers, which is, of course, what I alluded to.
Right. Tuffy Rhodes, he played 13 seasons in Japan, so 13.
So.
So, yeah. Yeah. And so with that, let's make a two-seam transition. Actually, this is almost a no-seam transition, a seamless transition.
It's like a little change-up. Let that slip right off your fingers.
Right, and talk about the Hall of Fame. Now, I think I said it on the show last year that until NPV puts Tuffy Rhodes into the Hall of Fame, I cannot take this museum, because they do call it a museum, I can't take it seriously. There's not one... Okay. There isn't a scintilla of negativity out there that would preclude Tuffy Rhodes from actually being a member of the Hall of Fame. Now, there's some negativity out there, but I don't think it should hinder his entrance into the Hall of Fame. So if that's the way NPB wants to treat not only Tuffy, but you look at what Wayne Grasek did. He gave us so much in publicizing NPB. I have been as well. I mean,
I've talked about talking to the Hall of Fame people about Wayne, and I haven't. I haven't been there.
Right. Well, we need to. It's the off season. We have no excuse now. We need to get together and do it as a group.
I can find an excuse. Trust me, I can find an excuse.
Well, I'm going to throw it away because it's not as good as mine. But anyway. I mean, we got separate issues with Wayne and all that stuff. But I just cannot take the Hall seriously. And if the powers that be don't take a player of that caliber of a Tuffy Rhodes and take him seriously and put him in, what am I supposed to think of the Hall of Fame, the voting, the whole process, the whole league? So that's where I stand. I think I said it last year, and that's all I have to say about this year as well.
Okay. Well, I did some. Well, of course, this was the funny thing was that I wrote my story about Tuffy in January. It wasn't just me. Jason Cosgrove also wrote a story like "What's Up with Tuffy Rhodes and the Hall of Fame," and Craig Calcaterra of MSNBC mentioned it. And as soon as he wrote about it, as soon as he linked to my blog, there was a. I think Full Count came out with a long story about Americans in the United States are upset about Tuffy Rhodes not being in Japan's Hall of Fame.
Egads, the horrors, the shock.
I know, the shame. Well, they should feel shame. I do crunch numbers on the side. It's sort of my hobby. I haven't, that number is too standing too erect. It needs to be crunched. And those numerals don't look right until they've been mangled a little bit. So anyway, I did a lot of that the last couple of weeks. I've been obsessing about this and in the lead up to my Hall of Fame voting last week. And I was trying to put Tuffy Rhodes in historical perspective, which is difficult because he did play a long time. I mean, he did play a fairly long time in Japan, like.
Well, he played more than 10 years, I think, safe to say, because he was...
Yeah,
he... I thought it was 11, yeah. But then he did have a
hiatus after he left. He was injured, and he had a hiatus after he left the Yomiuri Giants, and then did come back and played for Oryx. But he retired as a very good player, and I was curious where he ranked in terms of... I'd always known where he ranked in terms of sort of career value, which is useful, but when you compare people on career value, you get people who are like who play forever, whose value is the fact that they're durable and smart and good, that they can play forever, like Kazuyoshi Tatsunomi.
And Motonobu Tanishige.
Tanishige is even, yeah. is exhibit A of that. That class. But Tuffy was one of these guys, and I was talking about career value, and so I measured basically two measures of career value. I mean, a peak value. One is their best 5-year span of their career.
Okay.
And their three most valuable seasons anywhere in their career.
Okay.
Okay, so, and I use these three things, the ranking of how they stand in Japanese baseball history of their best 5-year span, their best three seasons altogether, and their overall total value. And Tuffy Rhodes comes out in the history of Japanese baseball.
Okay.
Period. End of story. He is the 10th highest 10th most valuable overall outfielder in the history of Japanese baseball. Period.
Right. Yeah. 10. Number okay. 10. Yeah.
Number 10. Okay. And just for, okay. Number one is Ichiro Suzuki, who isn't in the Hall of Fame. And two active outfielders are actually ranked higher than Tuffy. One is a Kosuke Fukudome, who's very similar, just has a little longer career.
Right.
And
right.
The other is Yuki Inagita, who's ranks really, really, really high. He's the 15th overall player in Japanese baseball history because of that just amazing peak that he's had. He had until 2018. That 2014 to 2018 stretch was historic. It was the third best, most production from a player in NPB in history. So he ranks really highly. So, but Tuffy's up there with, you know, there's nobody on the Hall of Fame ballot who has anything like the career Tuffy Rhodes had, but he's really middle of the pack. And hopefully, you know, people will look at that and vote for him because it's such a pop, it really is too much of a popularity contest.
Right.
People have been telling me, and it's, you know, it's like there are players who have supporters, groups, who publish, who make videos and put stuff on YouTube, you know, to sort of like drum up support among the voters. And Tuffy doesn't have that, and Tuffy's not in Japan. But there are things like there are lots of measures, and you can go on my website, jbalallen.com, and see all the, and if you look up Tuffy Rhodes, there'll be about a dozen stories talking about his different, you know, the argument. I think how I'm trying to point where he stands in Japanese baseball history. There's a lot of ways to look at it. I look at a few. So if you're numerically inclined, please go there. But otherwise, yes, I agree with John. It is a bit of a farce. It's not the voters' fault. I think that the system is a farce. But it's been the system. You know.
I mean, certainly that's a good excuse. But I mean, you have to as a player and as a league and as a voter, you have to realize, hey, this is a person who did incredible things in Japan and as a player, and this person should be in. Why? I mean, when you see a mistake, you should point it out. And we don't have anyone, or there's no mechanism, it seems, for people to say, hey, this is a mistake, let's rectify it. And everybody is just jumping on board and walking by. It's like the piece of paper on the floor in the office, right?
Mm.
That no one picks up because that's not their job. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to continue to ignore it. And
I don't want to besmirch other people. I mean, you know, Alex Ramirez is an interesting case. I mean, by my objective measures, Tuffy was 10th all time. Alex Ramirez is among outfielders is 24th. Also surrounded by a bunch of Hall of Famers, but also has, you know, the two MVPs is something that, you know, the two MVPs and the 2,000 hits are things that other people don't have. So people are going to look at those, and he got more votes in the past election. I think Tuffy's a better candidate, but I think Alex is also an excellent candidate. But there are people who, the number one vote, the person who was on the most ballots last year was Shingo Takatsu, who didn't get into the Hall of Fame. And so he's very likely to be the number one guy this year. And his overall career value was very low because he was a relief pitcher when relief pitchers were not used the way they are now.
Right.
You know, he basically was used in like seven, you know, the way he was used was about 70 or 80% of his potential value. And so he's not going to rank really, really high among pitchers. In fact, I think he's his career value is, by my estimates, the lowest of any player on the ballot. But he was also, for a time, the all-time career saves leader in NPB.
Right.
That time when Kazuhiro Sasaki was in the major leagues. So, and before Iwase passed him. So there's something to be said for that. And I think people understand that part, but people don't always understand the, I don't know. I think with foreign players, people are quick to see the negatives.
Right. Yeah.
And I think if you're somebody like Alex Ramirez, who has so few negatives, you know, I think he's conscious about that, of having his image is very important to him. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but he's very conscious of his role in the big picture.
Okay.
So Tuffy was not unknowing about that, but he was also kind of like he had a little more heart on his sleeve stuff, and so when things got to him, he blew up a few times. You know, he had a few punch ups, and people tend to remember that.
Oh. Yeah, but I you know, in the times that I've talked to Tuffy, it doesn't seem like he really even is worried about the Hall of Fame. It's a kind of thing.
If it comes, it comes,
and if it doesn't come, then it wasn't meant to be.
I want to say he's at peace with it. I think it's not a case of he couldn't care less, but it's 100% out of his control, and it's kind of that thing.
If not his focus.
Not in the least. He cares, I think, absolutely nothing about how other people see his career. Okay. As much as he's happy about it, but okay, move on. He's got better things to do.
And speaking of moving on. Because Jim said he didn't really have much to say about the Hall of Fame before we started the recording.
Okay, I said it. You're twisting my words a little bit. I did say it, but that's, you know what I meant.
Yeah, me twisting your words, that would be an all-day job. All right, let's go to the movers and the poster boys. So, yeah, I think about 5 minutes after we recorded our last show last time, Yoshitomo Tsugo, whose name is going to be butchered in the state. I shouldn't say is going to be. It is being hammered and cracked and slaughtered and dragged through the streets. Nobody can say his name. I think the people I heard one thing on Facebook, on YouTube, and the guy is not saying Tsutsugo. He's pronouncing the word as if the American style of saying tsunami, mm-hmm. by making the T silent. So he's saying Tsutsugo, and I'm like, this is a problem. But anyway, so it's not like we can't say peanuts. We say peanuts, so just take the end of the peanuts or the word peanuts and say Tsutsugo. But anyway, I digress.
Okay, good. I'm glad you were going to take the T out of peanuts.
Yeah, okay. Tsutsugo is going to Tampa Bay to play with the Rays. And I thought, as soon as I saw that signing, I thought, you know, this seems mutually beneficial. If... Mm-hmm. This team gives him a chance to put in a year, you know, at least if he's not killing him, mm-hmm. get him out there for a year and see what he can do for an entire season. Or, you know, if he's having trouble with this, that, and the other, give him the opportunity to make the adjustments. And so I like the move. I thought it was good, but I just, you know, I don't know. The little spiel that I saw on YouTube said, well, he's a legitimate power hitter and blah, blah, blah. And that's somebody just looking purely at numbers. And I thought there's context to this.
I think that was the Rays talking. And I think that's the Rays being positive. I'm not here.
No. The thing I saw was some independent guy who's not
The Rays were saying that. I mean, I think that was the Rays calling him and the scouts basically said, okay, the thing with Tsutsugo, quickly, is he has real power. I mean, he can hit the ball a mile.
Oh, yeah, he's got raw power, definitely.
He's got raw power. But the question is a game power, whether he's going to hit connect with enough good fastballs to make that usable. But I had scouts say, oh, yeah, he'll hit, he can easily hit 25, 30 home runs. But how many guys can hit 25 home runs in AAA, you know, who won't field their position well? And they said, you know, those guys are not – they're not a dime a dozen, but they're not a lot more expensive than that.
Right. And what else did I hear? I heard someone saying, will he be able to catch up with the fastball? And I'm like, well, it's not like the Japanese pitchers can't throw 95, 96. It's just that I don't know if it's a matter of catching up, because there are going to be fastball counts in the States where he can sit fastball. And if that's the case, I don't think he's going to have trouble getting the bat around to them. But
he did have trouble. I won't say he had trouble with a fastball in Japan. It was his weak point, though.
Right. Right.
And people have said, you know, what's going to happen? You know, people are going to throw him. You know, he's going to get a lot of heat, a lot of inside. You know, and that was a concern. That was a concern for teams that had concerns about him, and also the fact that the fastballs in America are of a different nature than they are in Japan, partly because the balls are different. And
right, and the stuff is different, and the approach is different. So I think he'll struggle a lot more with those things than he is just the fastball. But
my thing on, and I went through an evolution of my evaluation of Tsutsugo, mostly from talking to people who appraise major league talent, and it went from being basically he's not going to be a big help to he can be a big help if a team basically lets him, you know, helps him figure it out and commits to him figuring it out and doesn't take him out at the first sign of trouble. And my take on Tampa Bay is perfect fit.
Yeah, I thought it was a great fit. So, yeah. So
yeah, because here's a team that has excelled at taking guys that other teams are less interested because of perceived problems. And they're sort of like Houston Astros light, in the sense that instead of, you know, looking like the guy who has the best spin rate, you know, on this side of Mars, they'll take the guy whose, you know, spin rate is, you know, very high, but nobody's noticing it.
Okay, yeah.
And take that guy and give him a chance. Oh, and the reason is, oh, he has confidence issues. Well, we can fix that. You know, these are things we can work on. And so they get all these guys who are the, you know, they're really the money ball team now. I mean, they take the guys that other teams just aren't interested in because of A, B, and C, and they say, look, A, B, and C are workable.
Yep.
and they work on them and get great stuff. So Tsutsugo definitely fits that category. Great move for both of them.
And then we heard about Shun Yamaguchi being linked heavily and very closely with the Blue Jays. And I think I saw a report this morning in one of the Japanese newspapers that that deal is pretty much
It is complete, according to, right. According to Nikon Sports, that deal is complete, yes.
Right. And so, I you know, it's good to see this come to fruition for a 32-year-old guy posted by the Giants. And I was thinking about that, and I think we talked about the fact that probably because he's 32 and because probably the Giants didn't see a close relationship with the team down the road, that, you know, they were willing to let him go.
Good question. Okay, I here's another thing. Yeah, some, you know, the thing about Yamaguchi that's weird is all the mixed messages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the team owner comes and says, the day after, don't think this means we're okay with the posting system.
Right.
One time thing. Forget it. Don't ever.
Don't even bring it up.
It's in my presence.
Yeah.
Okay. The team's president, the same day, said, we have to evaluate every player on a case-by-case basis, and we have to consider people like Tomoyuki Sugano, who sacrificed a year of their professional baseball lives to play for us. So that's one mixed message, and here's the next. Oh, there was something about, you know, we were required to post him. And, you know, like, we were, why was that? Oh, because of our contract, we agreed to him. And they made it sound like they had to include the clause in, okay, first of all, listeners, and we've said this before, there are no multi-year contracts in NPB. There are personal contracts between the players and the teams that are completely outside the scope of NPB. So when a guy signs a three-year contract, it's not on file with the commissioner's office. The three-year contract is a separate deal that can be enforced through the courts. It has nothing to do with NPB. NPB only accepts one-year contracts. This is a one-year contract. We're done. This is why the players go and sign their contracts every year, even when they're locked up for 5 or 6 or 7 years, like Yuki and Nagita is. So the point being that part one of their contract said that Yamaguchi would be posted. The Giants agreed to a contract in which I'm sure they weren't able to sign him unless they agreed to post him, because he could have stayed in Yokohama 2 more years and been an international free agent. Instead, for 3.
He so had some leverage. Yeah, he actually had
So that
had
was
some
their
leverage.
Choice. But they made it sound like, oh, we didn't have a choice. You know, we were blackmailed into this. Like, the devil made us do it, you know?
The powerful Giants cowering in a corner. Right.
I know. So it's so funny. But you could tell the resentment in that. And you could almost tell that I have to wonder if the people who agreed to that contract are still – now, it could well be that the people who agreed to that contract are no longer with the Giants. And so the current people inherited that agreement. That would sort of follow from that. But the Giants did agree to that thing. And
now bite your tongue, Jim Allen. You know, people in Japanese companies don't get booted. They just get shifted to another part of the company where they can be less impactful.
Well, I'm thinking that deal was agreed to by Mr. Kator, Yoshitaka former GM, who isn't with the team. He's, you know, he works with them on a sign of a side business consultancy thing, but he's no longer the GM.
Gotcha. Okay.
But and also the team presidents come and go like you know, playing cards
or socks. Yeah.
So that posting is really interesting because of what it implies for the future. Okay. So that's Yamaguchi, and apparently that deal is at least it was reported 10 days or so ago as being 2 years for $6 million.
Okay. So, yeah, not sorry, big money. Noise. And then there's the case of Shogo Akiyama of the Lions. And So I woke up this morning and saw that Akiyama has narrowed his choices down to a couple of teams. And, you know, there's a lot of action there. One report said that the Reds are willing to put him in the leadoff spot and play him in center field. So that would make him as comfortable, you know, in a stadium like that where he's playing on artificial turf. That would almost feel like playing it, at the Tokorozawa Stadium. Tokorozawa Dome.
The domed stadium formerly known as Prince.
Yes. So, that's interesting how he's gotten a lot of looks. And we were talking before we actually started recording, and you said you got a lot of action, a lot of readership on your blog on jballisland.com and regarding Akiyama. And I thought, Reds fans, probably in our age group, who just discovered the internet.
Hashtag high heat.
And also are desperate for some kind of good news from that team that has been very bad since, I guess, the Eric Davis years and Barry Larkin years. So, I would imagine the Reds fans might be excited about something like this.
Right. Well, I mean, it's. I think it's less about them signing their first Japanese player in Shogo Akiyama, and more about the team is making moves, and the team has been making some moves, and they have been maneuvering and a little bit this year. And I'm going to go, you know, sort of to match the rest of MLB, which is returned to normal after a 2-year abscess, kind of in the off season player movement market. But the other team that it's funny because the Nikon Sports in Japan has been all over the Akiyama to the Reds, and they announced that the Reds had improved their offer after the Cubs and the Tampa Bay Rays had been the I guess the first two eager teams to pursue him, and of course the other was the Arizona Diamondbacks, who have kind of since they've acquired Cole Calhoun,
mm-hmm.
that they've been less vocal about Akiyama, according to the Japanese media. I'm basing this completely on. But the Hochi Shimbun, I think 3 days ago now, this would have been a Wednesday or Thursday, reported that the San Diego Padres have since joined the crowd. And on early Sunday morning in Japan, the Hochi Shimbun has again reported that now Akiyama's decision is down to the San Diego Padres and the Reds. So
yeah,
there you go.
Saturday morning. Yeah, it's still Saturday.
Oh, it is Saturday morning. Okay, so I'll just say that one again. Okay, and so okay. Saturday morning here in Japan, Hochi, which reported the Padres' involvement, now says that Akiyama's decision is down to the San Diego Padres and the Cincinnati Reds. So that is getting interesting. And unfortunately for the Reds fans, one of whom who tweeted at me, "How come this deal is not done yet?"
Because you're not in the room.
Yeah, well, I feel your pain. I want it to be over too.
right. So those are just some of the happenings with the internationals on the international side, and there have been a lot more additions across NPB that really should make the upcoming season riveting. We can't possibly go through all of them, but I just noticed that it seems that MPB teams are being really aggressive in acquiring imports this offseason, not maybe as players to carry the team like we've seen in the past, that they put a lot of emphasis on, we've got this player and we're going to be this kind of team this year, but that they're acquiring import players to add depth, to ensure that they have a guy who can come in and give them something, depending on, you know, what they want. It used to be that it seemed that a lot of times the acquisition of foreign players was basically they can hit for power and but I think in probably this past decade we've seen, well, this player can do something other than hit for power and.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're just trying to get well-rounded players now. It just seems that there's a different flavor of foreign player that the teams are coming, that teams are trying to acquire. And it just seems to me that this season, this offseason in particular, that we're seeing teams go after guys just to add depth to their team with some professionality.
Yeah, I mean, there's some. I mean, I want to throw out a couple of names since you brought up this broad and I think interesting topic that really hadn't, I guess, I can't say it didn't occur to me, but it didn't occur to me to the level that you summarized it, and that is the prototype depth guy here is Corey Spangenberg, who's done everything but catch and play first base in his major league career.
Right.
And so he's going to the Cebu Lions, where Shuta Tonosaki is I don't know, it's like Frankenstein and Frankenstein Jr., these guys who are just like can do I mean, they're just like they can do anything, you know, these two guys, and so they've got the master and the student or something. I don't know how that's gonna play out, but it was kind of interesting. But yeah, perfect depth guy, utility guy. And then the other side is sort of the classic coming to Japan guy in Adam Jones.
Right.
You know, the sort of the 25, 35 year ago, oh, the guy's major league career is kind of, you know, it's just not solid. But he's had a great career, but it's, you know, it's the end of the road. It may be the end of the road. And he's coming to Japan to do that. And the last guy I think we saw like this was 5 years older. That was Andrew Jones. We've had a few others, but at least Andrew Jones played here 2 years. So most of those guys who come, you know, they last about their term is closer to 2 weeks than 2 years.
Yeah, Kevin Youkilis, right? With
Kevin Youkilis,
yeah.
Sure.
The Greek god of walks didn't last very long. Yeah, I'm glad we got that interview in before he got hurt, unfortunately. Yeah, but yeah, I see where you're going. I see you're going. Johnny Gomes, yeah. So, that's what I've just noticed, and obviously...
No, I think that's interesting.
It's really making me want to even if it's a 2-day trip, go to Okinawa just to talk to a couple guys and hit up. I'm really seriously thinking about it. But some moves within Japan. I guess the biggest one is that Ryosuke Kikuchi of the Carp is going to stay here in NPB, saying the pace of the market was really slow in terms of him getting some interest from the MLB teams. But I was thinking, the market was stationary. But he's staying here.
Well, his agent, Mike Seale, explained it, I think, fairly well. Basically, for him to sign what is, and if Mike, if I'm misquoting you, my apologies, but I'm trying to summarize this. Essentially, his position is he's being sold as a utility infielder, and Mike and Kikuchi both believe that he can play on the left side of the infield. The fact that he hasn't is sort of like it's not quite the elephant in the room, but it's like, why haven't you? And the answer is because he was so gosh darn good at second base that nobody wanted to take him out of that. So that's one thing is, can he play in the left side of the infield? That was always going to be a little bit of a question, but I think anybody who looked at him play would think, well, let's give him a shot. Okay, and the other thing was that because he's primarily a second baseman, there are several second basemen on the market. There are several people who can basically do what he does who've already established themselves at some level in MLB. And so teams with holes were looking to see who was on the board, and when he's on a 30-day clock. So those were the issues facing his signing. And, of course, the third one is that he decided that he was not going to accept a minor league camp invite contract.
No, I wouldn't either.
I would if playing in MLB was important to you, I would. But having said that, because, A, if he went to MLB at the age of 29, okay, and he played half a year, he played some time in AAA or won a job in camp or whatever, never played in MLB, he can always come back to Japan a year from now. He's not going to be without a job. That's my take. So I'm disappointed in that. But having said that, I've always taken the stance that nobody knows what's best. Nobody knows more about what's best for Ryosuke Kikuchi than Ryosuke Kikuchi. So him, I'm guessing it had to do with his family and convincing his family. And, because as you said earlier, it's not a solo act.
Mm-hmm.
Life is not a solo act. So he had to get other people, he needs other people's support, and he has to work with them. And I'm guessing that, as it was the case with Nobuhiro Matsuda, the Hawks, that there were other issues, it wasn't just him, and that coming back to the Carp, or at least keeping those bridges, not burning that bridge with Hiroshima was really, really important to him, because the day he said he was coming back, he signed a 4-year contract extension. So
yeah, it's a lot of money. Yeah, and I love to watch him play. I'm glad he's going to stay here.
Sure.
And, I mean, it's going to be his year 30. Season. They don't list him as being very big. I just don't think there was a great place, a great spot, a perfect fit.
He wasn't
a great scenario for him to be in the major leagues.
He wasn't going to be a $2 million player in the majors, and he'll get more than that in Japan. He'll get $3 million a year essentially in Japan.
Right.
And so for him, it's a good deal. I would have liked to see him go to the majors, if only because $3 million can't buy the experience of playing in a different country. And
right.
And having said, anyway, moving along, the other move, the other similar move, or the other non-move, or I don't know what you want to call it, was Yuki Inagita, which I referred to earlier, signing a 7-year deal and basically writing off his major league future. Now, I'm going to guess that this is not a big surprise for you.
Not at all, but it's disappointing, but I didn't think he was going to go. Had he been with another team that was willing to post him maybe 2-3 years ago, I think when we talked about the fact that you said it was you. I didn't know that it was you, but I mentioned that someone at Kyoto had mentioned in a story that he would be past his prime, and I said, well, we don't know if he's going to be past his prime. This is probably 5 years ago. And
well, that was
but,
me.
Yeah, yeah, we confirmed that it was you when I made the comments, but I said, well, yeah, we don't know that for sure, though. And well, here it is, 5 years later, and yeah, he's probably past his prime. His body's starting to give out a little bit. So I'm happy that he's staying here. It's not a surprise.
I'm unhappy for the same reason with Kikuchi, and I'm also concerned about the way it happened. Because the killer was not, oh, I'll be 32 when I go to the majors. The killer was, because he'd already decided. I mean, he'd ostensibly decided. And now, again, I don't know what players really think. I can only know what people tell me.
Exactly.
And what they tell me and what people, other people close to them tell me and write. And my belief was that he was really, really sincere about going to the majors. However, the thing that happened with Yanagita was that he needed 145 days of service time, and he was injured in April. And by the time the Hawks brought him back, the Hawks activated him after saying all summer, oh, he can hit now, so we want to bring him back as a DH in July. And they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then they played him in a game in which he ran and hit. And he said, I'm fine, on August 8th. And they didn't bring him back. And they said, oh, it's going to take 10 games. Anyway, by the time they brought him back, any possibility, they brought him back on August 21st. And there was, the Hawks would have had to play in the Japan series, and it would have had to go on to 10 games in order for him to get a year of service time.
Yeah.
Yes. Here's the thing. I don't want to cast aspersions on the Hawks, but had the Hawks been generous and said, look, we have an extra spot. We've got 29 guys on the active roster.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of them doesn't have to play. Two of them don't have to play every day. We can have Yanagita on the first team because he means so much to us, and we owe it to him to make sure this year gives him a year of service time. Instead, they kept him on the farm team to play it safe. And they essentially said, oh, you know that thing about you becoming a free agent next year? Ha! Sorry. Oh, just too bad. It ain't gonna happen. It just got away from you. How sad.
Something nefarious. Yeah. Okay.
I don't think, and because Japanese teams and the way the infrastructure is in Japanese baseball, Japanese teams don't manipulate service time historically.
Historically and typically.
But the Hawks are also the most major league of all the Japanese teams.
Hmm.
And so that's a possibility. So, and I think people need to look at that to check the authenticity behind that, because it's not that it's bad, but that it is awkward looking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's all I had to say about that.
Yeah, the optics of it aren't so good. Okay.
Yeah, it's bad. It was a bad look.
It's a bad look, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. A couple other moves that caught my eye. One was Frank Herrmann, the reliever with the Eagles, is going to Lotte as a free agent. And then Hideaki Wakui is going from Lotte to Rakuten for cash. So... as you said before we started recording, he was sold.
Yes,
not
indeed.
To the highest bidder, I expect.
Somebody was one of the newspapers here was saying that there was in effect a 7-player trade between the Eagles and the Marines because of the free agent movement, Daichi Suzuki to the Eagles and Minamu Mima to the Marines, and Wakui went, and a couple other guys went, and Herrmann went, and you know, it's pretty much like they had a night bus service running between Sendai and Chiba.
It's a shuttle. Yeah, it's a shuttle. All right, let's go to fielding questions. All right, this one is from Stefan in Germany, and he sent it by email. He says, "Dear John and Jim, I don't have Twitter, so I'm sending you this email. I hope it finds you well. Have you seen the new Tigers movie trailer? The movie itself is coming out in February 2020, and it would be neat if you and Jim could tell us what you think about it." So what we think about the movie itself, which we haven't seen, but I did see the trailer. "And what Tiger content besides the championship should be covered? We definitely need English subtitles for this thing. Thanks for all the work, and I'm listening to your podcast when driving to work. I'm living proof that you have fans around the world." So, Stefan, thank you. Thank you very much. So I clicked on the... He sent the link to the clip of the movie, and so I love this. I hadn't heard about the movie. I did click on... He sent us a link to the movie trailer, so I watched that, and... yeah, it looks like fun, but this whole thing reminds me of what we saw earlier this month in Japan when the country threw a big parade for the rugby team, which won absolutely nothing, and ignored the Samurai Japan team, which won the championship in the Premier 12. Why are we celebrating losing? And that's what it seems like with the Tigers, that we're doing a movie on a team that has won one championship.
Well, has won one Japan series.
One Japan series championship. I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't consider the league championship a championship. That's just a pennant for me. So it has to be the Japan series championship. And Randy Bass is going to be in there, and he was part of the trailer. And I think it looks like it'll be a fun film to watch, but I don't know why they're doing a film about a losing team. So, what are we going to pay money to see when we go to the movie to see this thing? I would like to see... in no particular order, the Shinjo years, and especially when he was pitching. I would like to see more stories about Katsuya Nomura, because he was, in my opinion, probably the greatest catcher in NPB history, and obviously the second best home run hitter in Japan baseball history. And I would like to see a lot of stories on him. And I don't know, the 2005 team that won the Central League was really a good team, but it was treated like cannon fodder in the 2005 Japan Series when the Lotte Marines ate them up. So there's not really a lot. I don't know. I guess the JFK years, I don't know. What would you like to see, Jim?
Oh, more history. I mean, the Tigers were essentially... The Giants were the team that started NPB, that started the Japan Baseball Federation back in the 30s through the auspices of the Yomiuri Shimbun. The Tigers were equally a part of Japanese history. The Tigers were largely started not because of the Giants, but the Tigers were part of a professional baseball culture actually that preceded the Giants. They were hold a lot of the people who started the Hanshin Tigers came from the Japan's first professional baseball team, which was the Tokyo Baseball Sports Association, which predated the Giants, and it went out of business. But the remnants, some of the people who were involved in that ended up playing corporate league ball in Kansai, and they were really the movers and shakers behind the Hanshin Tigers. So I think that the Tigers' history is rich, and their recent history is frustrating. And 85 is sort of like the reason 85 is important is because it's their first championship since the two league era.
Right.
But they were a really, really great competitive team for decades that were just always, in that sense, just runners up way too often for theirs, and winning it all was a huge thing. So I think that historical context is probably what's missing.
Okay.
Why was 85 so important? It wasn't, you know, it just didn't come out of, you know, it just wasn't something that happened.
Yeah, I'll see the movie definitely when it comes out, and it should be really fun. And you said there were other teams that were making similar kind of documentary style
movies.
Yeah,
I've heard something. The Bay Stars made something over the winter I don't know how it was distributed, and I saw news yesterday that there's going to be a movie, something like Thank You, Yomiuri Giants, which is, I think, focusing on Shinosuke Abe. I can't give you the full story. I don't quite understand it. I just glanced at it when I was going through my
The Bay Stars, not so much, but yeah, the Giants, to me, that makes sense. But sure, if you want, I just need a lot of context, but every team has a story, and it would be nice to see that story,
sure,
and have it be told in a documentary style. So I'm not saying that the story doesn't mean anything. I just don't want to celebrate it because this is not the team that, to me, has a lot of winning tradition. There's a lot of tradition on the team, but it's not winning tradition. So. So yeah, I'll be excited to see it. Thank you very much, Stefan, for sending the trailer along, because I had not seen that as well. The next question comes from Bill via Twitter, and he says, in general, what are the restrictions placed by NPB clubs on both Japanese and foreign import players when it comes to them playing in the various winter leagues worldwide? Hashtag high heat. So I really have never heard about any restrictions. I've heard about a number of players individually playing winter ball, and I've heard about some of the foreign guys as well playing in the various leagues. But as you have talked about many times through the years, Jim, Dragons' former pitching coach and skipper Shige Kazumori usually took a group of his hurlers down to play overseas, in the Dominican in the winter. And last year, and I think the year before that, Tomu Onosaki of the Bay Stars doing really well and playing in Mexico. And he speaks, I asked him the other day, and not the other day, but this past season, English. Did you speak English? And he says, un poquito. And I'm like, all right, he's speaking more Spanish
half,
than he
does. He's half American. So.
Right, yeah. So and I've heard of a number of Rakuten guys pitching in the Arizona Fall League before. And there's baseball here in Japan as well, so it's not as if they have to go overseas to play. I think it's just better for their development to take on that challenge. But in terms of a quota or a limit, I really haven't heard of anything like that. You?
I have not. Teams are generally, it's a, I think, budgetary and time if they want the guys to go. Or I know that Yoshitomo Tsutsugo had tried to go to the Dominican Republic the year before he actually went, but he was ill. But a lot of the teams, I know the SoftBank Hawks have an extensive history of sending players to Puerto Rico. And I know Yuki Inagita spent several months there. Usually the guys are there for a couple of weeks. But it is the thing now. There's a Winter League in Taiwan. There's the Winter League in Australia. The Canberra Cavalry have a tie-up with the DeNA Bay Stars. I know Shota Imanaga spent a year ago was playing in Australia. The Cebu Lions had a tie up in Australia. I know, Yosuke Kikuchi had some experience in Australia. I know the Lotte Marines have an agreement with the Wellington Tuatara, which play in the Australian Winter League. They're New Zealand's professional team. So yeah, it's all over the place. And of course, one might ask whether this has anything to do with Xavier Batista playing winter ball when he's technically prohibited from playing in Japan until March. But
the card player who was busted for drugs this past season.
Yep.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
No, as far as I know, there's none. The teams, in fact, are getting more and more active because it doesn't add. You don't have to add a player to your roster to add depth when you can make your own players better by giving them more experience.
Okay. All right. Excellent. All right. Thank you for the question, Bill. Thank you, Stefan.
Yep.
In Germany. Wow. That that really touches the heart. So thank you very
much. Auf Deutsch.
Anyone else who has a question, hit us up on Twitter at JBW Podcast with the hashtag High Heat. Send questions by email to yakyujohn@gmail.com, or you can go to the Facebook page, leave us a question, comment, hints, suggestions.
Okay, and I want to throw a special shout out to the podcast fans who stopped me in San Diego at the winter meetings. So much appreciated.
Awesome. Yeah, that is awesome. I not only do I want to go to camp next year, I want to try to go to the winter meetings too. So we'll see if I can get any of this accomplished. Those will be my New Year's resolutions. Get to camp and get to the winter meetings in December. All right, guys, happy New Year. And like I said, this was the first last show of the year for the Reiwa era, so I hope you enjoyed it. We will talk to you next year in 2020. Enjoy your New Year's celebration.
And see you in Reiwa 2.